Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome back, everybody. Just amazing to have these two gentlemen on stage with me. When I was a teenager and I first seriously started buying records, it suddenly occurred to me to look at who made those records as well as who played on them. And the names Joe Boyd and John Wood and Witch Season Productions and a little picture of a witch on a broomstick seemed to turn up on all the albums that I bought, and I bought 18 of them with me today. I don't know if you can see them around the stage, and they all turned out to be absolute classics of folk rock. And you can, if you can't see the albums, they're by John Martin, they're by Nick Drake, they're by Fairport Convention, they're by Sandy Denny. There's just every name that you could think of at that time. And what I hope we might do, gentlemen, today is take people to a time and a place and evoke some music and some people. And the time would be the 1960s and 70s when you were both working together. And the place would be Sound Technique Studios, which was really at the heart of all of this recording. And the people would be some of the names that I've just mentioned. So please will you welcome Joe Boyd and John Wood to the stage. So we're going back to the mid-1960s now, and Joe, you're an American, and you're here in London. What brought you to London in the first place?
Well, I first came to London in the spring of 64 as a tour manager for a package called the Blues and Gospel Caravan with Muddy Waters and Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Brandon McGee, Sonny Terry, Reverend Gary Davis. And I kind of lucked into that job because I promoted some blues concerts when I was a student at Harvard, and I got to know a local promoter, and he recommended me to George Ween, who was a promoter who was looking for a tour manager. And so I came here, and this was a time when these artists, Muddy Waters, these fantastic artists, couldn't get arrested in America. And the first night at Bristol Colston Hall was packed. There were queues of kids waiting for autographs at the stage door. And I just kind of went, I'm home, you know. I wanted to be a record producer. That was my goal. And this is the kind of audience I want to make records for.
Meanwhile, John, I think you might have been working at Decca, were you?
I started at Decca. That's where I started learning to be a recording engineer, I suppose. And then through a series of a couple of stupid moves, I ended up at an independent studio, which was called Levy's Sound Studios, which was part of another company who owned Oriel Records. And I ended up there and didn't enjoy it at all. I was stuck there for 3 years and getting increasingly frustrated. And the technical engineer there, a guy called Jeff Frost, and I equally got frustrated. And finally, his mother put some money up, and we started a studio. I mean, it really was that.
Sound Techniques.
Yeah, and that was Sound Techniques.
In Chelsea.
In Chelsea, yeah. I mean, so Jeff left first to find a building, and in those days you had to... Recording studios weren't that usual, weren't usually sort of put together, so the classification was for a light industrial under the planning regs. So we ended up with this building in Chelsea, which had been a dairy.
Had a cow's head over the door, didn't
it? Yeah, it was owned by this family who had been supplying milk to the sort of west of London, I think, for the last 100 years or something. And by the time the building we were in, they actually kept cows in there 24 hours a day.
Really?
It was, yeah, milked, fed milked, and, you know, it was like intensive farming.
So quite a conversion that needed to go on to make it into a studio.
Well, by the time we got it, I don't know what it had been used for before, but we took the first and second floors. It was 1,000 square feet footprint, and then we knocked out the middle, so we had a double height section in the middle, so we had like 300 square feet one end, 200 square feet the other, and a big double height bit in the middle, and put a studio together, you know, as you
Jeff
do.
Jeff built the desk, didn't he?
Yeah, we hadn't got any money. I mean, much. So we ended up by having to build our own desks, build our own speaker cabinets, all sorts of. And before we'd finished building our own desk, we built one for somebody else. And in fact, what then happened is the whole business sort of split, and we had a manufacturing within 2 years, we got a manufacturing business as well as the studio.
So Jeff was upstairs building the desks, and you were downstairs recording the albums.
Well, it was a bit like that. It wasn't quite like that. We had to have a red light in the workshop, and as soon as the red light went on, everybody had to keep quiet and stop hammering.
So they had to stop building the desks while you did a take.
Or not use the coil winder or whatever. Yeah.
Well, I'm just interested in your recording technique, because I believe that your aim was to capture as much of the sound live, as it were, as you possibly could. Is that right?
Well, there was no other way to record in those days. That's what you did. You know, yeah. You got everybody in a room and you did the best you could with it. And it wouldn't matter really whether you were recording Judy Collins or a commercial for crisps.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to keep in mind the perspective of historically, in terms of the technical history. When I started working with John, we worked in mono or stereo, and within the course of, I don't know, 8 or 10 years of working together, it went to 4-track, 8-track, 16-track, 24-track, all within that period of time, each one completely transforming the way people would work. But when we started, it was, and when we finished, we still liked recording everybody together.
I think we always had in our brain, and your mindset, because when you set out on a session, or for me, when I set out, I've got an idea of how I want to see it finish, which sounds odd, but so you would always be thinking in terms of a whole. Of the whole, you weren't thinking in terms of a track here and a track there or whatever. You were always thinking in terms of the whole sound picture. So, and that's partly because of when we started, stereo wasn't even being used for pop.
So, was it about the placement of the microphones in the room?
Well, you just place them where I'd always placed them.
John's being, typically, dismissive of subtlety and complications, but the fact is, I think people who've worked in studios today, maybe not always, but in my experience, if you go into a studio and you're working with a young engineer and you're sitting in the control room listening to the sound of an instrument coming through the speakers, and its sound isn't quite right, it isn't quite exactly what you had in mind, or it's a bit toppy or a bit bottomy or a bit this or a bit that, the first impulse of a young engineer is to reach, and do something on the board. And John would never do that. John would go, mutter, mutter, and get up and go downstairs and either change the microphone, move the microphone, or move the musician. Because the great thing about Sound Techniques was because of this big space, this two-floor-high space, on one side there was the office and the toilet, and the toilet had plumbing under it. So it was deeper than the control room, which was on the other side. And then in the middle, you had the full height of the two stories. So you had three different heights.
And different acoustics, therefore.
And different acoustics. So you could stick somebody under the control room or under the office and toilet with a lower ceiling or in the middle with the highest ceiling. And there were baffles and things like that. So there was a lot of choice. And I think almost never did John or, you know, ever want to change the EQ. That was something you saved for mixing.
I want to hear more about UFO, though, because I did mention it earlier.
Okay,
you went away from that. So
I got fired by Elektra.
Right.
And so I wanted to stay. I wanted to manage the Incredible String Band, who weren't earning any money. And John Hopkins, who was just starting the International Times, wanted to stop being a photographer, which is what he'd been. And he and I got together and tried to figure out a way to pay our rent. And he had just had a big party at the Roundhouse for the launch of the International Times. Pink Floyd and Soft Machine had both played. And the atmosphere had been great. And I just said, why don't we just do a party like that somewhere every week and charge admission? And he said, okay, let's look for a place. And I remember, you know, in those days, he had a little mini, and we used to scoot around London looking at these venues, and he got a lead on an Irish dance hall in Tottenham Court Road. And it's very nice for me to, now you can drive south on Tottenham Court Road, but for most of my life in London, you could only drive north on Tottenham Court Road. But in 1967, we drove south on Tottenham Court Road and parked right in front of where the Blarney Club was at the time, which is now where an Odeon cinema, I think, is. And we made a deal with the Irish landlord to rent the place for £15 on a Friday night.
And Pink Floyd were the kind of house band.
There was either them or the Soft Machine, and then we added Crazy World of Arthur Brown, and then it got more.
So he used to set fire to his hair most nights.
Exactly.
Right. And so what was the atmosphere like at a good night in the UFO club?
Well, I would divide it into two parts. There was, for the first 3 months, it was like a meeting of a secret society. All the freaks around London went, wow, there's more of us than we thought. and people were tripping, and people were smoking dope, and it was just, you know, and we were showing W.C. Fields movies at 3 a.m., and, you know, I don't know, there was light shows in the corner and people taking their clothes off, and I don't know, it was very anarchic. And then Arnold Lane came out.
Which is a single you recorded?
A single I recorded with John at Sound Techniques. Yeah. And immediately the BBC refused to play it because it was salacious in some way about, you know, a guy stealing girls' knickers off the line, the washing line. And but it got to number 15.
And they could have hit every time, the BBC banning it, weren't it?
Yeah, exactly. and suddenly the whole atmosphere changed, because it was now people who, it was this period from March 67, peaking in June when Sgt. Pepper came out, and that whole, quote, summer of love, the phenomenon of psychedelic London, which had been an underground thing for a year before that, suddenly became an overground thing. And you had crowds of people in queues down the street, and the police searching people in the queue. And, you know, it became a kind of zoo. So the atmosphere changed a lot.
I want to ask you about Sgt. Pepper, because Sgt. Pepper has a place in your story when it comes to connecting with Sandy Denny. That's
right. Yeah.
Tell me about your first meeting with Sandy Denny.
Well, Sandy, I was, you know, I think I'd seen Sandy at Les Cousins or somewhere at some folk club, and I was.
And we should be clear, Les Cousins was a Soho folk club. There's a triple album out at the moment paying tribute
right,
to Les
yeah,
Cousins.
Yeah, exactly.
No, just come out by Ian A. Anderson.
Place. But in those days, there were. The folk world was kind of divided in Britain, and I was intrigued by that, by how, you know, because places like here, the first time I was in this room, I think at that end, I heard the Watersons without microphones, just singing, the four of them. And I heard, you know, Louis Killen, and I heard, you know, and it came mostly unaccompanied singers. And there was a whole circuit of clubs around the country, as I'm sure all of you know, where you really rarely saw a guitar, unless it was being played by Martin Carthy. and then there were other clubs, like Les Cousins, where you saw John Martin, where you saw Bert Jantz, where you saw John Renborn, where you saw guitarists and singer-songwriters. And I, in a way, I had come to England to get away from singer-songwriters. You know, I didn't have a big opinion about that. I kind of thought, I like the tradition, I like the rock, you know, the psychedelic scene, but singer-songwriters were not my cup of tea exactly. But Sandy was sang traditional songs, but with a big singer-songwriter voice and strummed her guitar a lot. And so I was like, not sure. And then I ran into her at the bar of Les Cousins, and she was hilarious. You know, she was just the funniest person, and just completely surreal as a character. And so then the next time I ran into her, I don't know, we ended up going for a bite to eat, and it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and she said, I'm never going to get home to Wimbledon. You got to drive me. And I said, I'm not going to drive you to Wimbledon. You know, you must be joking. It's, you know, it's miles away. She said, this was June of 1967, and she said, I have a tape of the new Beatles record, which hadn't been released yet, and everybody was talking about it. But a friend of hers had recorded it off, they'd played the whole record on Radio Luxembourg.
This is Sgt. Pepper?
Yeah. And a friend of hers had recorded it off the air, and she said, I've got that tape, and if you drive me home to Wimbledon, you can hear the tape. And so, okay, you know, so we drive to Wimbledon, we go, and she's tiptoe, you know, her parents were asleep, this dark, sort of quite large house. And so I said, okay, well, let's hear the record. She said, well, you know, my parents are asleep. I said, well, come on, you promised I'd come all the way out here to Wimbledon. And so we ended up in the coat closet in the front hall with all these coats around us and a little Wallenzack tape recorder. And she turns it on, and there it goes. You know, Sgt. Pepper, the whole thing. We listened to the whole thing, the two of us sitting there. And I think for her, it was a real moment, you know, because I think she, in that moment, realized that what she really wanted was the bigger canvas of working with other musicians and doing things, not just singing Scottish ballads on, you know. And I think very soon after that, she went to Denmark to do that record with the Straubs. When she recorded her first version of Who Knows Where the Time Goes, because she knew she was gonna have to sing their songs, and so she felt, I better have a song. And that was the first song she ever wrote.
She was 19 or something, wasn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, she'd never written a song before. Oh, let's see, I'll write a song. Oh, I guess I'll write Who Knows Where the Time Goes.
Unbelievable.
You know, I mean, Anna McGarrigle, just as a footnote, heard that Kate had started to write songs in New York, and she thought, well, to compete, my sister I better write a song too. So she thought, oh, I better write a song. So she wrote Heart Like a Wheel. So the first song of these two.
John, we're coming to the studio in a moment, but no, I just want to get Fairport Convention as well, because you were obviously involved with Fairport Convention. Did you bring them together with Sandy Denny, or did they do that themselves?
You know, it's a funny story that I basically know. I mean, I thought about it, because I, from the beginning, the minute I signed Fairport, I thought it was all about Richard, that he was such a talent I couldn't not sign them. But I wasn't that sold on Judy Dybel as a vocalist. And I didn't really say, you know, you got to anything, but I sort of, when they said, well, we're thinking of maybe changing, I said, good idea. And, but I didn't recommend Sandy, and I had to go to America with the Incredible String Band, and I called my office every day, and I called my office one day, and they said, guess what? The Fairport have added Sandy Denny as vocalist. So I went, whoa! And the next one, as soon as I got home, I went straight to a rehearsal, and I thought that the reason I didn't think it was an obvious idea was because I thought Sandy would kind of eat them alive. I thought that she was such a powerful personality, and so, you know, she cursed and she drank and she shouted at people, and
they were quite polite.
And they were all very little, polite little Muswell Hill schoolboys, you know. and then I got to the rehearsal, and Sandy was completely well behaved and very, and because she was completely in awe of Richard. You know, I think the minute she realized what she was dealing with Richard playing guitar behind her, she was like, okay, anything you say. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, got very quiet and very, you know, calm. And just, whatever, Richard, whatever you say.
You must have heard this developing, John, in the studio when they came to do Heartbreaking.
Yeah. Oh, well, yes. I mean, the first Fairport album was for Polydor. Was really hard work, and I can't say that I was terribly impressed. I remember Joe telling me that, you know, Richard is going to be one of the greatest guitarists in the world, and this is like 16-year-old, fresh-faced. What? And it really was hard work, the first one. And then when we did what we did on our holidays, what Joe says about sound is interesting, but there was always some tension between Sandy and Ian. You
know? Oh, yeah.
Ian Matthews, who was
at that time. Ian really hadn't come from that. Yeah. He'd come from sort of... He was more of a country singer?
At the time, he'd been in something like...
I don't know.
He was in a group called The Pyramid. Which had a gimmick, which were, they had three vocalists in front of the curtain and the band behind the curtain.
Right.
But it was very much a sort of singles pop. Outfit,
and Fairport Convention was very different from the Fairport Convention that became the folk rock band, wasn't it? Because this was influenced by American artists.
Yes,
mostly
it was sort of Jefferson
Birds.
Aeroplane, Birds, you know. Yeah. Those were the influences, so they were very different. And it wasn't really until, I mean, I always thought the real breakthrough, I suppose the sort of big difference, was when we got to the end of Unhalfbreaking, the third album, the whole album was pretty much in the can, and we recorded. We started it all at Sound Techniques, and we'd only got four track at the time, and so we finished it off at Olympic in Barnes, and running it all up to eight track and doing the overdubs, and then they finally said, "Well, we've got this one title we want to do." Dave Sawbrick's coming to play the violin.
Because he wasn't a member of the band.
We did two titles that night. We did
C2 Dwarf was after the main event. And it was an afternoon. It wasn't even an evening, I think. It was an afternoon. Right. And the main event was Sailor's Life. Yeah. And they said, we don't want to rehearse it or go through it. We're just going to do it. And that you've got to do it in a one-er. And
that was significant because it was the first time you heard Swarbrick
and
Thompson.
That was significant because that was straight out of the sort of traditional British songbook, for whatever, you know. Because all the other songs, you know, well, most of them are self-penned in the obligatory Dylan number.
Was it the first time that Swarbrick had a pickup on his yeah. violin as
yeah.
well?
Probably. Yeah.
Yes, first time he went electric,
yeah.
as it were.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He'd never played yeah. with an electric pickup, but yeah. he was sort of intrigued by it.
Yeah. And it went down as a oneer. I mean, that's.
Yeah.
And then we have to deal with the tragic events that yes, unfolded yeah, before yeah, Lington yeah, Leith yeah. because there was a car crash, a van crash, as they were coming back from a gig when the road manager fell asleep at the wheel and Richard Thompson's girlfriend and Martin Lamble, the drummer, yeah. were yeah, both killed. Yeah. And that must have been the most horrendous blow for the yeah. band, Joe. Did you speak to them at the time?
Well, yeah, I was in America.
We were in America. Yeah. I think we were mixing the album.
Yeah. And I flew back yeah. and, you know, and their first, I think I spoke to Simon or Ashley or Richard, somebody, first thing they said was, it's over, we're never going to, the group will break up. Because they couldn't, you know, they just didn't want to imagine carrying on without Martin.
And playing the material that they'd recorded with Martin would have been yeah, very difficult yeah. for them, presumably.
Mm. And eventually they, and this is how we come to have this word that's being used tonight for the subject of this talk, folk rock, because they finally said, okay, we're going to carry on, but we're not going to do any of the same material. We're going to have a whole new repertoire. And what they'd done with Sailor's Life really resonated with them. And when they decided what they were going to be as a completely new blank sheet was a band that played British traditional music with that lineup. And that became Lington Leith.
You know. And yeah. Dave Swarbrick was added to the
yeah,
band.
Dave, yes, or, yeah,
Dave
yeah.
Mattox arrived from yeah. he was from a dance music background.
Yeah, and yeah. I think I've always felt that was one of the most important things that made that work, was that Mattox was not a rock drummer. He was not a backbeat heavy guy. He had played for, you know, big band jazz, big band sort of tea dances and, you know, Mecca ballrooms and stuff like that. And so he didn't have that rock impulse. His impulse was, where is the dance rhythm in this? And so that was the what he would play. And I think that's what made the record, that's what makes the record endure, is the fact that it's rhythmically so unusual and so different and so new, it's something nobody ever really did before. I mean, you know, obviously Jimmy Shand records as a drummer, you know, but this was applying a whole other sort of thought process with Ashley and Richard and Simon working with Mattox.
And John, were you aware that you were creating a new sound? Because that's really what was happening in the studio when you were recording Lington Leith.
Oh, God. Richard and I had terrible arguments in the recording of Lington Leith, actually, because Richard was very hung up on the band. The Big Pink album had come out, yeah. and he was trying to make me... somehow he wanted DM to sound like...
Leave on Helm,
you know. And he's like wanting to roll the top off the drums. And I mean, it's like everything that I would never do normally. And no, we did have quite a lot of argument about it.
I remember, John, you know, the sound of the Big Pink, the sound of Leave on Helm's snare drum on that is very thud, thud.
But it's because of the kit he plays.
Exactly. And they would keep saying, but John, we want it to sound... And John kept saying, if you want it to sound like that, you have to play it like that.
Yeah, or get Leave on Helm.
Get a new drum kit.
Yeah. No, and really. And I'd
so it was rather fraught in its genesis for you.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And I can't say it's my... There are two or three tracks on it I really like, but the sort of... Unhalfbricking is still my favourite Fairport album.
I think it's true to say that no... two Fairport albums have the same
right.
lineup from that classic period anyway.
Yeah.
Was that disturbing for you as a producer, or did you enjoy that?
I mean, it was depressing that, I mean, I was really blindsided with Sandy and Ashley leaving right after Leech and Leaf came out.
So you established this new sound, yeah, and then two and of then the key people who created it leave the band.
Yeah. And but I have to say that, you know, that year from the time that Sandy and Ashley left, when Dave Paik joined, and that was a funny story, because Paik, basically they, you know, they needed a new bass player, and they were putting ads in Melody Maker and all this kind of stuff. And Swarbrick kept saying, I know this guy in Birmingham, he's a really great bass player. And they kept saying, Swarb, just back off, you know. You're not a rock and roller, you're a folkie. What do you know about electric bass players? You don't know anything. And he said, no, this guy's really good. Well, who's he play with now? The Ian Campbell Folk Group. And they said, Richard and Simon said, come on, get out of here, Swarb, you know. And he just made such a pest of himself that they said, okay, bring him down, we'll audition him, you know. And so they set up this, it was like four bass players coming at different intervals, and they set up in a rehearsal room, and I went there, and Paik comes down, he's a bit shy, and he comes in, he plugs in, he has this electric bass, not a stand-up the way he plays with Ian Campbell. And so I think they decided they'd get rid of him quick. And so they said, okay, we'll do Tam Lin. And they start off Tam Lin at like double speed. And it has all those very complicated bass runs that Ashley had recorded, you know. And Paik just goes, you know, like playing absolutely the parts perfectly in time at speed and more powerfully than Ashley ever thought of playing them. And they're all kind of looking at him like, who is this guy? And within about 15 minutes, they had a new bass player.
Wow. Let's move on to some other artists that you work with. I mean, I want to talk about Nick Drake, obviously, who played a big part in both your lives. I wonder how you recall your first meeting with him, Joe.
Well, you know, he came into the office because Ashley Hutchings is the one who saw him, heard him play, and thought, got his phone number, and then gave it to me and said, call this guy. He's really interesting. I called him. He came in, left me a tape, shuffled, you know, very quiet, didn't say much. And then I heard the songs, three songs, and I thought, wow, this is pretty amazing. And so I called him up, and he came back in, and we, you know, we had a very nice conversation. He agreed with everything I suggested about the, and a lot of what I was suggesting was kind of influenced by the new Leonard Cohen album, and also by In My Life. And then,
So you were suggesting arrangements to him for the
he
songs?
Said, yeah, and but then of course we had that weird experience, you know. In the book that's out, Richard Morton Jack's book tells a little more backstory about during this time that we were trying to figure out how to do this record. His relationship with Robert Kirby was just evolving.
So you were looking for an arranger.
Right. We hired somebody recommended by Peter Asher, who'd done some string charts for the James Taylor record on Apple. And then we didn't really like it. And
Nick certainly didn't like it.
John and I didn't like it either.
And Nick was suggesting Robert Kirby.
Yeah, he said, I've got this friend at college.
Yeah.
And, you know, because, you know, Joe and I are going, sort of, well, but not 100% agreed with it. But anyway, but, you know, so what? So his friend at college. And I never realized until Richard Morton Jack's book came out how long a gap it was between the Houston stuff and Robert turning up. But anyway, the sessions with Robert, we'd already recorded two or three titles with Nick, with probably with just solo cello and other, you know, bits and pieces.
Danny Thompson.
And done stuff with Danny. And anyway, so Robert comes in and he tells us what the lineup he wants, which is basically double string quartet, you know, and We booked him out of the ECO, I think.
And Robert proved himself, obviously, in that session.
So, Robert turns up, you know, and I think the first thing we did was Way to Blue, and I just pushed the faders up, and
I'll never forget that moment because you're in this control room up above the studio in Sound Techniques, and John was down arranging microphones, and then he would always want to listen to each instrument separately. And so I'd hear this line with sort of in the distance the other parts, and I go, "Oh, that sounds interesting." And John, no, you can't hear it. I want to hear that. Now I need to hear the cello on its own. And I'd say, "Can I hear it all?" No, you can't hear it now. And and so I was sort of thinking, I want to hear it all together. And finally, John pushed all the faders up, and this sound came, and I just went, "Oh my God!"
And did you feel the same, John?
Oh yeah. I know quality when I hear it.
But the issue for Nick, presumably, was how to promote his record, because you could make a beautiful record, and you did make three beautiful records, but he had difficulty going out live, didn't he?
Yeah, he was. I mean, the thing that's so frustrating and so maddening about the story of Nick and the one moment where the circumstances were perfect, it's where his story crosses with Fairport and Legion Leaf, because that, in the autumn of 69, when we'd finished this record, and they were going to launch their new lineup with a concert at the Festival Hall. And it happened because Roy Guest had a date, and he said, "Come on, let's do Fair. Let's get it all rolling. Let's put Fairport on," even before the record came out. And so nobody had heard what they were going to do. And the audience was real fans. They were fans of Fairport. They were fans of Sandy Richard. They were fans, I dare say, even of Witch Season. And the place was full. And because of the tragedy, it was very respectful. Everybody was really on their best behavior. And John and Beverly came out and did...
John Martin.
Yeah, John and Martin. Beverly Martin came out and did half an hour as the opening. Because Fairport couldn't do a whole concert because they didn't have a big enough repertoire. They'd only done enough for a record, 40 minutes, 45 minutes. So that was all we knew. That was all they were going to do in the second half of the concert. And so John and Beverly did half an hour. They were good. And then went off, and Nick Drake comes out just by himself. And he says nothing. And he plays a song, and then after the song, he retunes the guitar. And he has no jokes, no patter. All he does is look down at the guitar and retune it. And then he plays another song, and then he retunes his guitar. Because and what I later learned about Nick was that unique sound of his chords on the guitar come from his attempt to emulate the piano chords that his mother made, because she was a songwriter and she wrote songs that were positioned somewhere between Noel Coward and Flanders and Swan and I don't know, something like that. But she had this very self-taught way of playing the piano, and Nick grew up with that sound, and that's the sound that he's replicating in these odd tunings. But he said nothing, and then he played his 20 minutes or 25 minutes and got up and walked off, and he got this huge ovation. The crowd just, and they kept absolutely still for the entire time, and I ran backstage and said, "Get back on stage and do an encore." "Really?" And he did. He kind of went back and he played Things Behind the Sun, which I'd never heard, which he'd never offered to us for the record. We were in the middle of making Brighter Later, and he'd never suggested this incredible song. And you could see what he could do with how an audience could respond to him. But then, I would see him at a club and there's people drinking beer and putting their glasses down on the table, and he takes 5 minutes to tune, and everybody starts talking to the person at their table, and he mutters something very, very quietly into the microphone. Nobody stops talking. And then he starts playing very quietly. Nobody stops talking. And the whole thing is so demoralizing to him that he just would leave the stage. And, you know,
and John, were you aware of the pressure on him and the mental health issues starting to emerge?
Well, yeah, but not until well after. It was well after, brighter later.
Well,
really.
But I have to say, John and his wife at the time were very, very supportive of Nick and used to, invite Nick for dinner.
And he used to come and after Five Leaves left, he used to come and stay for a couple of days. I was living in Suffolk. And, one day we even took him over to see Danny Thompson, who was living in.
Really? Yeah. Well, presumably they're two very different characters.
They were and they weren't, funnily enough. Nick was always... I always felt it was a real clash of cultures with Nick. I don't think Nick was ever really suited to the rough and tumble of a popular folk, whatever you want to call it, musician. I mean...
It's true in a way... But there's another side of that, which is that I loved seeing Danny and Nick together because Nick was very shy and he never said anything. Yeah. And Danny would come in and slap him on the back and say, "What's your cat got your tongue?"
Yeah. You know, it's a shame that they never gigged, actually, because that probably might have worked.
Yeah, because Danny could have probably talked to the audience. And,
and just, I suppose in some ways, Nick... I think Nick always needed reassurance, in a way.
Could he be assertive in the studio? Did he know exactly what he wanted?
Oh, yes. I'm the most assertive person I've probably ever worked with.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because he wanted a different approach for Pink Moon, didn't he?
Well, even before that, when we were recording Five Leaves, when we were recording Brighter Later, at least two tracks went down the tubes because he wanted to change the drummer, and that's how we started using Mike Kowalski.
Right. As I understand it, he wanted to be more stripped back, to be more.
Never knew this at the time, but apparently this interview he did with Jerry Gilbert, saying that he just was, that's all he wanted to do for his next record. He just wanted to just do it with guitar and in the studio with me, and apparently. I never knew that.
Did he tell that to you, Joe? Obviously.
Well, yeah.
The
thing was that we were finishing Brighter Later as I was preparing the ground to leave for California. And, you know, in retrospect, you know, I was, at the time, you know, I was, 28 or something like that. And I was just burnt out from trying to keep Witch Season alive. And the idea of moving to California and having a salary and having somebody else worry about the payroll, I just felt, that's what I need. And all the artists, one after another, all the artists that I dealt with at Witch Season started doing something against my advice. You know, the Credible String Band became Scientologists, Richard started arguing with me over his solos, and refused to allow Poor Will and the Jolly Hangman to go on Full House, which I thought was essential to make the album rounder. And one after another, there was one thing. And then Nick, at the end of Brighter Later, when we finished mixing it, he turned to me and he said, "The next album I'm going to do is just guitar and voice." And I thought, well, you don't need me for that. And so when the offer came to go to, work at Warner Brothers, I said, yeah, I'm out of here. And so that was the end of 1970. And then he went in the studio with John and made the album that now sells twice as much as Five Leaves Left or Brighter Later. Not but, twice as much, but a lot more.
Yeah. And of course, before I'd even done that, actually, I don't know if Joe even remembers this, but Joe left me Joe's legacy for me when he decided to go back to America was, he said to me, do you think you could make a record with John Martin, solo record with John Martin for £2,000? And that was Bless the Weather. And that was my first.
So that was a nice legacy. So
the first time I actually put a producer's hat on, for what it's worth.
But just to finish on the Nick Drake story, obviously it has a tragic ending, as we know that he died of an overdose of antidepressants and the coroner recorded a verdict of suicide, although I think, Joe, you might doubt
that.
You
know, I'm
just going to get to... Because, John, I think you had to call Joe and tell him...
No. We were in America doing something when we both
No,
were
no,
out,
that, that's we? When that's when we heard about
No,
Martin.
I know about Floyd. Nick Fairport. But Nick...
I was in California. I don't think you were there.
Yeah, I think I was. I think I was because we didn't. Neither of us went to the funeral.
That's right.
You must have heard the news of his death, and that must have been
somebody. Yes.
Terrible,
and I remember. And I think it may have been Sheila, my wife, who called me. But I mean, we weren't surprised.
It wasn't a huge surprise.
Yeah, we weren't
because
surprised.
He'd been getting worse.
Yeah, he was getting worse and worse, and here's a guy, I mean, here's the story of Nick in a way, from A to Z in the studio. You know, he, in the studio, I don't think I'm exaggerating. John will probably tell me I'm exaggerating. But we, at a certain point, John and I got in the habit, when we were recording Nick with a bunch of other musicians, Nick's guitar playing was always perfect. He never made a mistake. And so we would sometimes switch off the monitor of Nick's guitar and voice even, and listen to the bass and drums and the strings or whatever else was going on, because that was where the little subtle mistakes might happen that you would not want to miss. You would not want to say, okay, we've got a good take, and then find out when you go to mix it, there's something a little wrong. And because Nick was just perfect. And then we'd listen back with Nick in the mix, and it would be great. But we would have stopped, okay, let's start again, because the bass player made a mistake. And then 4 years later, we're in the studio recording those famous last four songs, Hanging on a Star and all those. And Nick couldn't play and sing at the same time. He laid down a guitar track and then we overdubbed voice. And the contrast between this consummate master, you know, who was absolutely more in charge of his instrument than almost anyone else I've ever worked with, more in command, I should say, and this guy who struggled to put down a guitar track and he couldn't sing and play at the same time well enough to record. That was the deterioration of Nick.
The reason I haven't got the original album cut here is because the albums, I've got a box set of the three albums, but the reason I haven't got them is because they're £500 each now. Those original albums.
Yes,
you know, that's how much they go for. Let's talk about John Martin for a second, because John was an incredibly interesting character.
Yes.
I remember watching a BBC 4 documentary about him and his excessive habits and all of that. So when you're working with John Martin on Bless the Weather and on Solid Air, what was his approach in the studio?
Well, I don't think John was ever very confident. Certainly the two records I did with him, I don't think he was ever very confident when he made them. Bless the Weather was easier to make than Solid Air, because I didn't have a problem with getting him to use the people I wanted him to play with, and because we used DM, I think Peggy's on it,
Dave Mattox,
Danny's on it, but then when we came to make solid air, he decided that he wanted to use a complete... He'd been doing stuff with Kossoff and had wanted to sort of change direction. And I don't know, obviously didn't see himself in a folk dimension at all. I think he saw himself much more as a jazz person. And the first session we ever did for Solid Air, which was at Sound Techniques, he turned up with this rhythm section that he determined he was going to use. I think we had Rabbit on, we still had Rabbit on keyboards, but the bass and drums I'd never worked with before. And I thought they were terrible. And anyway.
Did you tell him?
I didn't have to. I fell down the stairs, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I literally fell down the stairs at Sound Techniques. Because as you already said, we had a very eccentric staircase that the original staircase up to the office was made of Dexian. gap on the last step. Anyway, I went over, sprained an ankle, and we had to postpone the sessions, and because I couldn't work, at which point we couldn't get the drummer and the bass player back. So luckily, we got Danny back.
John sacrificed
got
Danny Thompson himself.
Yeah, we got Danny back.
And DM.
And then we went into Basingstrasse, as used to call
it. And then that changed. I mean, that's another classic album, of course.
Without your sprained ankle, it could have been very different.
Yeah, it could have been a bunch of old rubbish.
Well, without my sprained ankle, I think probably he would have fired me off the job because I wasn't getting on at all with this rhythm section.
We're going to have to draw this to a close unless there's an urgent question. I just wanted to ask you about your relationship because I read that you've been described as the good cop, bad cop. Is that fair?
No, I mean,
don't know which was the good cop and which was the bad cop. By the way, I'm not going to venture a view about that.
No, I mean John always had a slight, you know, that debate about Levon Helm's drum sound. You know, I mean, I would sort of be, oh, how great you guys bought the Big Pink album, isn't it great? And then you know, Mattex would say, come on, John, can't you get my snares? And John would say, you know, don't talk rubbish. and so there was that element. But also, without the artists around, I think one of the things that has been the most formative and important thing for me in learning about producing records was the good luck I had in, you know, ending up at Sound Techniques and working with John. Because in subsequent years, I worked with some very great engineers. But, you know, they're used to being nice. They're used to pleasing a client. You know, they have clients who come in who are paying well. You don't want to really rub them the wrong way. John never worried about that, you know, and so I felt, but it was so great, it was liberating, because I felt free to say, I got an idea, let's do this, let's try this, and John would say, you're out of your fucking mind, and I would say, oh, really, why, and then he'd explain why, oh, okay, well, I guess that doesn't work. But sometimes I would say, I don't care, we're doing it anyway. But it was great to know that there was this sort of control mechanism that I could push the boundaries and try new ideas and things, and I could rely on John telling me I was out of my mind when I was.
Right, well, it was also a two-way thing, you know? I mean, I would never have got to learn about half as much as I ended up by knowing about music, and I would have never had the opportunity to work with some of the musicians I've worked with. You know.
If it wasn't for Joe.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I had in some ways a charmed life, because, you know, if I hadn't found somebody else I could shout at, I'd have been out of What have I been doing? I don't know.
Ladies and gentlemen, will you please say thank you to Joe Boyd and John Wood?
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.